Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Hello, you're listening to Mark Thompson on the Music Mill. I'm with you for the next hour. Coming up, we'll be talking to Russell Whiting, who was the Labour parliamentary candidate for Suffolk Coastal back in May. We'll be talking to him about what it's like being in such a high-pressure role. And I'm delighted to say that I'll also be joined in the studio by actor Martin Ross, talking about his experiences. Martin has come to this profession in later life, so I think it will be interesting to get his perspective.
Thank Mark now. Tweet at Mark Reckons.
Mark Thompson with you here for about the next 55 minutes. As I mentioned, we're going to be speaking to Russell Whiting very soon about his experiences as a parliamentary candidate. Just before we do that, I just wanted to tell you about my experiences of not being a parliamentary candidate, just for my sins, which is that I did used to be a member of the Lib Dems, and I actually put myself forward to be on the candidates list, which is kind of a hurdle you have to get over before you can even stand in a parliamentary seat for the party or even be selected. And I failed. Yeah, they made you do like a half-day kind of hot housing series of tests and so forth. And I was fine with the media stuff, as you might expect. I've got a bit of a mouth on me. But when it came to things like representing values in action, I think was one of them, and various other ones as well. So I fell before I even got past the first hurdle, unlike my first guest, who I'm delighted joins us now. Hi, Russell.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Good. Did you have to go through some kind of process like that before you were selected?
The Labour Party is a lot freer with their candidates. Any Labour Party member can apply for any constituency.
Right, I was obviously in the wrong party then.
That's right. Well, you know, there's always time. and then, yeah, so all you have to do is get through a shortlisting meeting, which is kind of key members of the constituency, ask you various questions, and then you go to a hustings meeting with every member of the constituency, and you get 10 minutes to put your point of view across. Questions and answers, and then there's a vote.
Wow, much easier.
Yes, it is. Well, that's why I ended up being a candidate.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say, Russell, but I suspect you were probably more suited than I was. So once you had been selected, let's start at the beginning. What actually made you want to be a candidate in the first place?
So I joined Labour in 2010 as a kind of, I'd been involved in the election in 2010 in Broxtowe, in the west of Nottingham, where I was living, was increasingly worried about the future that the Tories were offering. So, decided that the best chance I had of getting involved was to join a party and become active. And then, when it came up, the opportunity to stand in Suffolk Coastal, which is the constituency I was born in and lived in for 21 years. I thought, what better place to represent than the people that I know so well?
Yeah, it's interesting you say born and lived in, because that always becomes a point of contention during an election campaign, doesn't it? How local, in quotes, is the candidate?
Yes. I mean, we had the five candidates in Suffolk Coastal this year. Myself, I was born, raised there, family history there, all my family still live there. I was splitting my time at the time between London, where I was working, and Suffolk. The Conservative MP, who'd been the MP for 5 years and won again, was parachuted in 2010. The Lib Dem and Green candidates were both local, and the UKIP candidate actually lived on the Isle of Wight, where he was a councillor. So it did become quite a key part of our campaign, especially at hustings meetings, when we always tried to out-local each other.
So is Therese Coffey not actually from Suffolk, the Suffolk area then?
No, I think she's originally from Liverpool. She stood in the southeast of England in the Euro elections. She stood in Wrexham in 2005, and then she tried to get elected in Norfolk and Surrey for 2010 before she settled on Suffolk.
Yeah, so she served her time then. There's a grand tradition, isn't there, of candidates for the major parties having to stand in some seats where they've got no chance before
That's
they
right.
then get selected
for... I think the official word you're looking for, Mark, is challenging seats. Yes. we call them hopeless seats. But
I see.
Challenging is what the party machine likes to call them.
Fair enough. Okay. So once you were selected then, I mean, how did you find life as a candidate? How far out from the election were you selected first?
I was selected on Friday the 13th of September 2013, so about 18 months before the election.
Well, that's quite a long run, isn't
it? Yes, it was.
Okay. So how quickly did the action hot up? Were you finding that you were having to go down there most weekends? And
Yeah, so I was there every weekend anyway. But we started campaigning in the September, And then we went up to Christmas, and then we started again mid-January because we obviously had the European elections in 2014 that we were building up for. And then we went up until July, and we had August off in 2014. And then we just went straight through from September until May, every Saturday and Sunday, outdoor knocking.
And that must take some dedication. I mean, I've done some door knocking in my time, and I did stand in a council by-election, which was fairly intense for about 4 weeks, but the idea of doing that pretty much for 18 months solid sounds like we're taking almost superhuman effort. Did you not find yourself flagging at various points?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, probably the best thing I could say is the Saturday after the election, not immediately, but the next Saturday, my wife and I were at home in the morning, and we sort of turned to each other and said, what did we used to do when we spent time together? Because we literally hadn't spent any time together for the 18 months previously. And I was working full-time in London and routinely doing 80, 90 hours a week with all the other work that's involved, and was really, you know, there were times when I sort of thought, this isn't worth it. I know I'm not going to win. Why am I putting myself through this? But then someone would, you know, you'd have a good conversation on the doorstep, or you would be able to help someone through casework, and that was really what kept me going.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about it being a no-hope seat. I mean, I was just looking at the results, and you got just over 10,000 votes, and Therese got 28,000.
That's right.
So, I mean, that, by any definition, is a, well, let's use your word, challenging. So that must have taken a psychological toll as well, really knowing that ultimately, no matter what you did, you were not going to win. And I know candidates never want to admit that during an election campaign, but realistically, you knew you weren't going to win and you weren't going to even come close, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in those circumstances, you have to be realistic. So what I said at the hustings meeting when I was selected and what I said throughout the campaign was I wanted to come second at in 2010, Labour had slipped into third place behind the Lib Dems, I think on about 8,500 votes. I wanted to beat UKIP, I wanted to come second, and I wanted to get more than 10,000 votes. And in the end, I got 10,013. So I just scraped over the line on the third, you know, the third challenge that I set myself.
Yeah. And the stuff that you were saying about, you know, not having seen your wife very much at all for months on end, I mean, you know, do you think that that combined with some of the other issues, which we might talk about in a minute, combined to make it very difficult for, I don't really know how to phrase this, ordinary people in quotes, because it doesn't really sound, don't take this the wrong way, Russell, like you're particularly ordinary in that respect. I mean, to have the level of dedication to do what you did for that time suggests that you are somewhat extraordinary. But we always hear about how, you know, we want ordinary people to be in Parliament. It almost seems like the hurdles that are put in place prevent ordinary people from getting there.
I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, to go back a step again to the selection process, it cost me about £350 to get selected, and that was in a seat where only three people had applied, and, you know, it's a hopeless seat, but it still cost me £350.
What was that money spent on?
So you are expected to send one leaflet promoting yourself to everyone in the constituency. There are,
and you're expected to do that out of your own money.
That's right. Unless you can get a trade union to sponsor you, or, you know, or you can raise money from elsewhere. But we only had 4 weeks from when it was advertised, when the seat was advertised, to when that had to be done. So there was no chance of a trade union sign off in that time. And actually, all three of us, I think, were in the same union. So we would have, you know, that would have not been particularly helpful. So 420 members, I think there were at the time, so that's 420 second class stamps. And then I had to go leave work early on three occasions for evening meetings, paying for additional trains at peak time there and back in the constituency.
I mean, if you were standing in a seat where there was a pretty good chance of you winning, or even a safe seat, then you could probably justify spending that sort of money, because ultimately, you're going to become an MP and they earn £70,000+ a year, and you're pretty much guaranteed that job for 5 years unless something very strange happens. So you could recoup your outlay. But in your situation, you knew that wasn't going to happen. So this was just money you were spending. And I guess what a lot of people might find quite strange about that is, you know, £350 is a lot of money to some people. And actually, as you point out, you know, this this was a seat where you were only competing with two other people. But if you were in a seat where you were competing with a lot more people, say one that was a bit more competitive, and although might maybe not an ultra marginal, might be a seat that with a following wind you might have a shot at, but probably still wouldn't win, it might cost you a lot more than that.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's a real problem and something that all political parties have to look at, because it is affecting the makeup of Parliament.
You think that, because that was going to be one of my questions, do you think that the people that are in Parliament are almost self-selected by means of not just the kind of the personality and the drive they have to get there, but also the fact that they've got a fair bit of money?
You've got to have money behind you. I mean, I know of stories of candidates who have paid thousands of pounds to get selected. I could have paid, you know, I could have spent a lot more. I could have maybe spent a bit less, but, you know, that's easy to say with hindsight. But I think the problem is that not only the cost, but the time involved. You have to be in a sort of job where, you know, I mean, we might talk about this in a minute, but you have to be in the sort of job where you can be very flexible with when you leave early or you don't come in or you make up time elsewhere or whatever else. And that really is a barrier to, you know, to people. My wife, for example, as a teacher, would never be able to say, I need to leave at lunchtime today because there's a shadow minister visiting, or I want to go and talk to these people to try and get myself selected. So that's another barrier that gets put up.
Yeah, there are lots of barriers, aren't there? And I think what I find frustrating about this debate is that, I mean, I've been following this sort of question, and I have talked about this issue and I've written about this issue as well numerous times. And nothing ever seems to change. So you always get the parties, seemingly to me at least, paying lip service to this question, where they'll say, well, yes, and we have this fund in place and we have plans to help this, that and the other. But the truth is that actually, as long as there are candidates who are willing to fund this themselves, there's no real pressure on the parties to change very much, is there?
And it's very easy for, you know, every party to kind of have two or three people who they can show up to the media and say, look, this guy was, you know, whatever, he was a normal person, this girl was a normal person, they got through the process, so therefore the process must be working. The fact of the matter is, the vast majority of MPs either have worked in a parliamentary role or a policy role, and I include myself in that, or have gone down the special advisor route, and these are people without, you know, a lot of experience in the real world sometimes, and then we wonder why our parliament doesn't reflect society.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you raised there about... So you actually worked in policy research, did you?
That's right. I was working for an animal rights charity as a political advisor, which meant that when Parliament was on holiday, I was able to take time off much easier. I was able to be a lot more flexible. My employers were still, you know, really, really kind and really generous in allowing me to do that. But it's not something that I would have been able to do, you know, if I was working on a building site or if I was a nurse or a teacher or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as well, given that your job was policy advisor, you were therefore in an environment where people maybe understood a little bit more that not only were you doing that job, but you were also trying to get selected initially and then elected. It, because you were in that world, it perhaps wasn't so strange when you went to your boss and said, I'm going to need a bit of time off because a shadow minister's coming tomorrow morning and I need to have the morning off at short notice.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, an additional advantage is, jobs like mine, I'm talking to MPs a lot, I'm talking publicly a lot. One of the people who I was standing against was a full-time mum, lots more life experience than me, a range of different experiences, but the first time she ever addressed a public audience, I think, was at the time when we had our selection meeting. So that's, you know, that's a big advantage that I and people from my background would have, when, you know, in, some would say, I'm sure, that she would have made a better candidate and a better MP because of those experiences.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's not really one I'm not sure I've really come across that specific point before. I've talked about the money and I've heard about the money before and the time off and the, you know, perhaps being a special advisor gets you in the right networks. But just the raw basic political skills of being able to stand up in front of a bunch of people and make a speech, that isn't something that comes naturally to a lot of people. And I think you're right that people who've perhaps worked in and around politics will have gleaned the skills necessary to be able to do that and appear effortless at it, which is obviously going to be a big advantage when you're trying to be selected.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, even, you know, to say to someone, we want you to make a speech for 10 minutes, that seems fine. But actually, when you sit down and try to speak for 10 minutes, it's a really long time. And to structure a speech and to put arguments together, is not something that comes easily the first few times that you do it. And the first few times I did it, I was awful. But it is something that you need to practice. And, you know, the Labour Party does a future candidates programme, and I'm sure other parties do the same thing. But again, I feel it's just paying lip service to what they think people want them to be doing rather than actually making genuine changes.
OK, so we've talked quite a lot about the problems here, but what do you think the solutions are? Because, again, apart from, I mean, I've spotted the outlier thing that you were talking about, that parties will occasionally push forward some person who, you know, doesn't appear to come from the standard background, but they're always the exceptions rather than the rules. How can we get to a situation where the exceptions become the rule?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that's going to happen overnight, is it? Because it's kind of institutionalised in the system. I mean,
you see, that for that reason, I'm not sure it's going to happen at all, ever.
Well, I mean, you might very well be right, because the thing that I find is you find candidates, you know, when we're trying to get elected, all the candidates will say we need more people from more different walks of life in politics. And then when they get elected, they just stop saying it because they're either in a safe seat where they don't want to change the system because it risks their job, or they're in a marginal seat and they haven't got time to worry about, you know, big picture things like that because they're so focused on fighting to maintain their seat at the next election. So it's something that the parties are going to have to come together and work on. And unfortunately, in this country, we don't do that very often, do we? Parties coming together.
Well, indeed. And actually, I don't know what your view is on another, perhaps slightly insidious thing that I've noticed in recent years. I remember seeing Adam Afrier, who's a Conservative backbench MP, being interviewed. And there was an article on him, and he was listed as an expenses saint, in quotes. And what that means is that I don't think he'd ever claimed his second home allowance, and he'd hardly claimed any travel allowance. He had either one of the lowest or the lowest expenses claim of any MP in Parliament. And this was touted as a really great thing. You know, here's someone who isn't trying to game the system, and he's saving the taxpayer money. But Adam Afrier is worth tens of millions of pounds, so he can afford to do that. And I think what concerned me about that was that if candidates and MPs are starting to score political points and climb the greasy pole by not having to claim expenses because they can fund that from their own private wealth, then surely what will invariably start to happen, especially as we see things like MPs. I know MPs did have quite a big salary increase recently, but there was a huge furore about it, and it very nearly didn't happen. And a lot of MPs have been pressured into saying that they will give away their pay rise to charity. So I'm not saying that they're poor by any means, but you could imagine if this went on for 10, 15, 20 years, eventually the salary of an MP would actually be, certainly compared to what it is at the moment, quite low. And with these kind of the pressures on expenses as well, I mean, do you think that actually things are going in the opposite direction to what we'd like to see, and MPs or potential MPs are being put under pressure to not even claim what they'd be entitled to at the moment?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, during the campaign, one of my pledges was that I wouldn't claim for travel from Suffolk to London if I was elected. But that's only because I know dozens of people who commute from Suffolk to London, and they don't have to, they're not able to claim that on expenses, and an MP is earning a lot more than that. But I think there's a really dangerous precedent that is set when very rich individuals from whatever party, or individuals who have other means of income, are then putting pressure on other candidates to be able to say, I am going to claim for this but not that, or I'm not going to claim for anything. We need to, in a way, we need to get over the expenses scandal and realise that, you know, so many of these expenses claims are genuine, but the system does need to be more transparent, and to a certain extent that has happened. But we will only get people into politics who we want in politics if they are able to make a living out of it. Now, I think the MP for somewhere in Lincolnshire, who's a Tory, said that he couldn't live on £90,000 a year and he couldn't support his family. I don't think many people would have sympathy with that. But when you're working 70, 80, 90 hours a week, living 4 days a week away from home, you know, I think it's right, with the responsibility that an MP has and the decisions that they're making, that they are well remunerated for that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a time, I think it was about 2 years ago, when the discussion and debate about the MP's salary increase was happening. And I remember, I think I wrote a piece about it on my blog, and I'm sure I tweeted about it. And then suddenly the phone started ringing, and I was getting call after call from radio producer, TV producer, can you come on and talk about this? We need someone to come on and defend MPs. They couldn't find any MP. I think there was one MP who was willing to go on and defend the pay increase. But apart from that, I think it was Lembit Opic, actually. And actually, he wasn't an MP by then. He was an ex-MP.
Yeah.
I don't think they could find anyone else. So I was on the media about seven times in the space of 24 hours talking about this issue. Because it's such a toxic third rail issue for MPs to talk about. But I think you're right. I think we do need to get past this idea that, you know, MPs are all on the make, all on the take, and, you know, they're just, it's snouts in the trough. Actually, you know, I think, like you say, if someone's working 70, 80, 90 hours a week, and actually there's another aspect to this as well. I'll get off my hobby horse in a minute, but we often hear, oh, MPs only work 30 weeks a year.
Yes.
That doesn't take into account all the stuff that they do in their constituencies. I mean, OK, so you had to work very, very hard as a candidate. But actually, once you're an MP, you have to keep going around your constituency, knocking on doors, especially if it's a marginal or there's a risk it might become a marginal. You've really got to keep going. You've got constituency casework. You'll every weekend, probably lots of evenings, there'll be all kinds of things you're invited to that you're expected to go to. And it'd be one of those things where if you don't go, it will be noted that the MP didn't attend your due. So there's a lot of pressure on MPs to do all sorts of stuff. The idea that, you know, you'll see these photos of the chamber almost empty on like a late on a Thursday afternoon, thinking, oh, the MPs, they aren't doing anything. They're all back in the constituencies doing stuff, or most of them are.
And that's, I mean, you know, these pictures that crop up on Twitter that I'm sure you've seen of, you know, these are MPs debating this very worthy issue, and there's three of them. This is MPs debating their own pay rise, which they don't even do anymore, and it has a packed chamber. I think it comes down to political education, really, doesn't it? You know, you and I know that a Thursday afternoon is normally a motion that is not binding, so it doesn't matter if MPs vote or not, and it's a good chance for them to get a head start and get into their constituency, to go to that event on a Thursday night that if they're not at, someone will try and make political capital out of. But the average person who pays very little attention to politics doesn't see that their MP is in perhaps a different part of the constituency, or at an event, you know, supporting another MP in a neighbouring constituency. We've got to really, as you say, get over this idea that MPs don't do anything, because, you know, they're some of the most hard-working people, I think, that we've got in Britain.
Hear, hear. And I don't think you hear that enough, actually. So well said. Just before we wrap up, I just wondered, can you maybe just give me a quick synopsis of, you know, your best experience on the campaign trail, because you must have had lots of them in 18 months, and also maybe your worst experience.
Well, the highlights were always finding people on the doorstep who had voted one way in the past and were now coming around to vote for me. I had one fabulous experience when a woman came up to me in a Tesco's in the constituency and looked at me in the freezer aisle and said, "I know you, but I just can't place you." And it turned out that I'd put a leaflet through her door and she'd recognised the face but hadn't made the connection. There was another woman who, it turned out, had been to school with my Nan and recognised my family name, and I was able to get them back in touch with each other after 50 years, so that was nice. I guess the worst experience was probably the very first hustings event that I did in a town called Aldborough, and someone asked a very detailed question about housing, and I thought, this is a question where I'm just going to have to piggyback off the rest of the answers, and I'm going to have to, you know, I agree with Nick kind of thing. And obviously the compere asked me to go first, and I just stood up and I gave the classic politician flannel answer and got heckled because I hadn't answered the question, and I just went bright red and felt about 3 inches tall, and I thought, I've got to do this 11 more times. But luckily I kind of picked up my hustings performance after that.
Yeah, I think anyone who's had any kind of experience with public speaking has probably been there, so all sympathy to you there. OK, well, thanks for coming on tonight, Russell. It's been great speaking to you.
No problem, my pleasure.
And how can people get hold of you on social media and the like?
I'm on at Russell Whiting on Twitter, and yeah, that's how you can get me.
And just very last question, do you think you'll stand again?
Oh, I would like to. I don't know if it'll be in 5 years' time, although I would dearly love to be a candidate in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. I think family situation may rule me out of that one, but I would definitely like to have another go, probably in not such a challenging seat.
Well, I was going to say, if you do get selected for another seat in future, I hope it's one that you've got a much better chance
That's
of
right.
winning.
My wife would agree with you.
Great stuff. OK, thanks. That's Russell Whiting, who was a Labour parliamentary candidate for Suffolk Coastal at the general election.
On Music Mill FM.
Yes, Mark Thompson here with you for about the next half an hour. So we've just been talking politics, but politics is something that I talk about all the time. So I thought that tonight for the second half we'd talk about something else. And I'm delighted to be joined by Martin Ross, who is an actor. Good evening, Martin.
Good evening, Mark.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. Now, I thought one of the reasons why it would be very interesting to talk to you, I mean, I'm sure just talking about acting in general will be interesting, but particularly in your case, I hope you don't mind me saying, but you're of a slightly more mature variety in terms of the age at which you came to this profession. So this isn't something that you studied at university and then went on to RADA or one of the other drama schools and then have been doing for the last 30 years or so. This is something you've only come to quite recently. I think you said when you're about 50 you started doing it.
Yeah, I was 50, probably late 49, bordering on 50 before I took it up, yeah.
Yeah, and what made you decide, because you did some other stuff first, you've had several different careers, I think, from what we were talking about before
yeah,
we came on air.
Yeah, goodness. Well, originally I was trained in electronics at college, but it was the last thing I wanted to do before I, the last thing I wanted to do was electronics when I came out of college. So I tried everything, and by the time I was 27, I'd had 25 jobs or something like that.
25 jobs?
Yeah, it was pretty a mixed bag before I decided that actually electronics was the only thing I could do.
Yeah.
So I started a business up. And then I had about 18 months, prior before that, it was about 18 months as a lead guitarist in a band.
Yeah, because that's quite unusual as well. That, you know, not a lot of people have done that sort of thing, have they?
No, I guess not. Although there's an awful lot of people out there that do try, but again, to do it professionally is hard.
Hmm.
But I was playing guitar since I was eight, so I was quite proficient really by the time I was returned professional. But it got to the point where I didn't really get the kick out of it anymore. So. Hmm. The business was the next logical step, so I started the business up. That was in the electronics repair servicing of computers back in 1980s when it all first kicked off.
Hmm.
Did that for about 20 something years, and then about 26 years, something like that. Goodness. And then decided that we were going to sell up. We moved to Devon from Medway up in Kent, and oh, goodness. We then decided that we were going to set up the house, and then we bought a yacht to go sailing. So,
see, again, that's not something that most people will have experienced. So you were a guitarist in a band for 18 months. You then started a business, ran the business, then sold the business, then bought a yacht and went off sailing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we crossed the channel to France, then we went on to Spain, and then we got holed up in Spain, and the boat stayed there for a year, ate into our budget too much, so we couldn't finish the journey, so ended up selling the boat, came back, and then I was at a loose limb really what to do. And so my wife said to me, well, what do you fancy doing? So I said, well, I'd rather like the acting. So she said, well, if you don't do it now, you never will.
Because you had actually done a little bit of acting earlier on, hadn't you?
A tiny bit, yeah, but that was more of because the director of the billboard is computer in for repair.
The television programme, The Bill, that used to be on ITV.
Yeah. And I managed through talking to him. He got me a part on there as an extra, which turned into a featured extra, which was my first taste of professional sort of what it's like to be on a professional set. But I only did the two episodes because the business was quite demanding and it was more safe than going to an area that was as precarious as acting. And so that was that. And so until I wound the business down and did the yacht thing, sold the yacht, came back, decided that I was going to do the acting properly and bite the bullet. And so I did. I got some headshots together and applied for a certain role in a feature film that would come up called Hawk the Movie. And to my astonishment, after meeting the director, I got the script come through the door about 6 weeks later, offering me the main supporting role, which was surprising to say the least. But we completed it. That's now in... That was in... I think that was 2009, something like that. 2010, but it's only now out in a distributor in America at the moment.
I mean, I think what's quite fascinating to me about that, because I'm not sure I've talked about this on air before, actually, but I've done some amateur dramatics in my time. So mainly in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was in about seven plays in the space of about 3 years with a drama group in Guildford. And then I on and off, I've done it. I did one in 2005 and one in 2009, but very much amateur. But I mean, it means I have a little bit of a kind of inkling of what that world is like. And the idea that someone who has never really done very much acting anyway and has had all these other careers, apart from the guitarist thing, which is a little bit off the wall, the rest of the stuff, running an electronics business, all of that, that's a fairly standard, probably most people could relate to that. Indeed. The idea that suddenly at the age of 49, 50, you turn around and think, I'm going to become an actor. And then pretty quickly after you decide that, you get cast in a film. I mean, that seems quite unusual. Do you think you were lucky, or do you think actually your kind of innate acting skills had always been in there and you just needed a conduit for them?
I think, looking back, you often hear about luck in many areas of any form of success. Now, you can, whatever is success is measured in various different ways, but I thought that to get the luck, you have to put yourself in the position to get the luck. So without putting yourself in the position, you're not going to be lucky, are you? So you have to put yourself out there, if you like. So my take was, well, whatever I've done in the past, it's always worked, so put yourself out there again. I didn't just put myself out there, I did read up, you know. I didn't just put myself out there to be an actor.
Yeah, sorry, I made it sound like you just clicked your fingers and decided to be an actor, but I'm sure there was more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, I did click my fingers and say I was going to be an actor, but the process of actually becoming a professional actor was I had to read up, I had to read as many books and study the different methods of acting that there are. And there probably isn't a book that I haven't read on the subject, or a film that I haven't watched, or I worked hard to get to the point where I thought, I can actually do this. I think I can do this. And then I put myself out there and got the roles. So it was quite a ride.
So that first film that you were cast in then, how did that go?
Very well, yeah. It was their top streaming film when it first came out for about a month or two, I think. Then it dropped off. Then it picked up again for some reason. It is quite an amusing film.
You said it was kind of a little bit like in the vein of This Is Spinal Tap, but more related to acting rather than musicians.
Yes, instead of musicians, it was about a director who was totally incompetent making a film, but through sheer luck and determination, he manages to make it.
Yeah. It actually sounds like my sort of thing. I'm going to have to look it up and see if I can watch it. So that was quite good. And then you've done some more stuff since.
Yeah, after that, I started to string along a few sort of reasonably paid jobs. And then once I got three together, I was able to join Equity. So I got the Equity card then I joined Spotlight. And once I got those two, I was able to get an agent. And once I got the agent, I started to get some more and more come through.
Because agents, I mean, you know, maybe I shouldn't base my view of agents on the character played by Stephen Merchant in Extras by Ricky Gervais. But it's not just that caricature that, you know, I think the reason why that character works so well, for people who don't know it, Stephen Merchant plays this basically bumbling agent that doesn't really do anything, and Ricky Gervais's character, Andy Millman, gets really, really frustrated with. But you see that kind of pattern crop up quite a lot. And usually stereotypes are there for a reason, but I'm guessing agents do a lot more behind the scenes, and you wouldn't have them otherwise, would you?
No, I think once you get to the level of professional acting, the better agent you get, obviously, is the benefit for both of you, because they only earn out of you getting the work. So it's to their benefit to get you work, so they earn. But they work damn hard. They really do at that sort of level.
And presumably they're very well connected, and they could get you in front of auditions, in front of directors that you'd never be able to do yourself.
Yeah, indeed.
So they're kind of like gatekeepers to the whole process.
Yeah. I mean, they do the networking on your behalf. So again, you know, it's a little bit like the politician, I suppose, that what goes on behind the scenes is actually a lot harder than is actually up the on the front end of it.
So how do you actually go about getting an agent then?
There are agents out there that will take actors on that aren't members of Equity or on Spotlight. They do prefer it, but I'd only go to an agent that would say that it would only accept people that are on Spotlight, because they tend to be the ones that have the better connections.
I see. So The agent that you've got, have you been with the same agent the whole way through?
No, I've had the first agent I had, sadly, retired, and then the next agent I got, which is the one I've got now, which I've had, I think, for 2 years.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned, actually, when we were talking earlier on, that you've done some adverts as well, and I think for jobbing actors, adverts can be quite a lucrative way of making money. I mean, you quite often see, you know, people who maybe, you know, have bit parts in Midsummer Murders or something cropping up on adverts. It seems to be that, you know, that's what pays the bills while you're waiting for the other parts to come along.
There is big money in commercials. It's going down, it has to be said. The money in them isn't even... I've noticed the pay for commercials has gone down in the last 3 years, 2 to 3 years.
Right.
I got shortlisted for a commercial last year. I think it was Land Rover or British Airways, one of the two. But it was an astonishing buyout, and I was down to the last two, and I didn't get it. But I'd already bought the Ferrari in my head. So I was gutted for that one.
Yeah, I bet that was quite gutting. I mean, one thing that I obviously have experienced this at a very, very minor level. In fact, I realised that it was about 3 years ago, I went for an audition for a part in Little Shop of Horrors, which was going to be a production in Reading. And I didn't get the part. It turned out I wasn't good enough. I wasn't a good enough singer. And actually, I knew I wasn't, because the way they did the rehearsals was like a workshop where everyone stood around and sung various songs for 2 hours. And actually, I was clearly nowhere near as good as most of the people there. But that was the first time I'd ever not got a part, because in the world of amateur dramatics, it's kind of like, you know, you don't have to be absolutely amazing to get the part. You know, as long as you're all right, then you tend to get cast. But obviously, as a professional actor, you must have experienced, you know, lots of auditions where you didn't get the part. And I think maybe one thing that puts a lot of people off is just that idea of rejection. I mean, most people in their day-to-day jobs don't really suffer very much rejection, or if they do, it can become quite an issue. Whereas a kind of a part of the job of being an actor is you expect to go for 10, 20 auditions and not get 19 of them.
Absolutely.
And maybe get the 20th one. And you have to cope with that. Do you think it takes a special sort of very resilient, robust, almost kind of, you know, elephant-hided person to be able to do that and not let it get to them?
I don't think it's resilience. I think it's just an attitude. If you've got the attitude where I don't consider not getting a role as rejection. It's I just ban the word from my vocabulary. Rejection and actors just shouldn't be together. That it just doesn't mix. So it's a case of, if you go for a role and you don't get the role, somebody else gets it, it's just purely that the other person was more suited to the role than you. He looked, or she looked, as soon as they walked through the door, the casting director thought, that's the person, that's the look I'm looking for. And no, it wasn't anything to do with your performance, because if you believe that, then you go down the road of self-doubt and start asking you questions and questioning your skill, your you know, can you do it? So it's not rejection. It's nothing to do with your performance. It's just the fact that the other person was more suited. Simple.
I mean, I suppose that sounds like quite a philosophical approach that you're taking there, that you're kind of, you're looking at it, I would say, like a kind of glass half full type situation, where you know, you're looking at it through a very positive prism, I guess is what I'm saying. I mean, I've heard some stories, so I'll give you a concrete example. When Miranda Richardson went to audition for the role that she was ultimately cast for of Queen Elizabeth II in the second series of Blackadder, so the very famous, you know, where she's a very high-pitched voice, she almost sounds like a little child, that role. And when she turned up, they didn't really have any idea what they were looking for. They were looking for someone to play Queen Elizabeth. And she turned up and she did it like that, and they cast her on the strength of that audition. So that's obviously an example of where an actor's turned up, and it might not have been the way she looked when she walked in, because I'm sure by the time she was dressed up in the costume and the hair and everything, she looked very, very different to probably what she did at the audition. But on the strength of a kind of characterisation, do you ever feel under pressure when you're doing auditions to kind of have done that level of preparatory work where you've maybe tried to think outside the box for a character and maybe give the director something maybe they didn't even know they were looking for?
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. You know, sometimes you're given the script on the day, and sometimes you're given the script the day before, and sometimes they want you off book, and sometimes they say it's okay to bring the script with you, you know.
Do you think it's better to have to have learned the words so you can inhabit the character a bit more?
I prefer that. I prefer it that way. Yeah, to get off book and then go in there with the another aspect of it that you can actually add on to the lines that you've got in your head. There is that as I was saying before, that if you walk through the door, you could like you've just mentioned, you could induce that thought that a casting director had not even thought of, and you walk through the door, that's kind of interesting. You know, you've stirred something in them that you didn't know you were doing, and they weren't looking for it, but you've just done that. And so you're not competing with other actors in that respect, are you? And so those other actors that they might view, some will will think they were rejected. Others will take the positive view as I was more suitable for that role, and that's just how it is. But it's not rejection.
So you haven't really gone through any formal, at least, training for this. You didn't go to drama school.
No.
I don't think you've taken any acting lessons, is that right?
No.
You did some research yourself where you've read books and you've watched DVDs
Lots.
So I guess informally you've sort of trained yourself in that respect.
Yeah, you can define training in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wonder though, when both you're auditioning and also when you've got a part and you're acting, where are you reaching to for your... Because I'm thinking about, so my day job, I'm a software engineer. So when I'm writing computer software, I have quite a deep well of both experience and also formal training, university education, and various training courses I've been sent on that I can reach down to and think, okay, well, what's the right thing to do in this situation? Do you find that you're thinking back to the various books and videos that you've watched about this, or do you think you're maybe more tapping into your kind of life experience? Because having had lots of different jobs and lots of experiences, like you said, you were on the road with the band for 18 months, you travelled on a yacht to all around the place and ended up in Spain, all of that stuff. Do you find that you're kind of drawing on your well of life experience more than perhaps someone who's straight out of drama school who's 22, 23 years old would even be able to do?
For certain, yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that gives you an edge and an advantage over some younger actors then?
I guess it must do. It's certainly given me the confidence and self-assurance to go for things that someone wouldn't do if they were younger and had just come out of drama school or have done that training without the life experience. Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I think the older you get, the more things you do in life, the more self-assured and confident you become as a person as you get older, I think. And I think, yeah, that's absolutely, the life experiences have definitely helped.
So as an example, earlier on you were talking to me about a role that you played that was actually quite harrowing, I think you said, where you had to go, your character had to go back to Germany where your character's honeymoon had happened in order to get a puppet fixed because your character's wife was dying. And that's obviously a very emotional thing. Mm. Did you find yourself reaching back in your memory for times that were very emotional in order to get yourself into that state?
The Stanislavski approach, where you draw on...
I'm not up with all these technical terms, Martin. So Stanislavski, so that...
Well, that's kind of... That approach was to get yourself into an emotional state is to draw back on to things that, you know, like someone close to you died. That would then induce your emotional state to go back to that.
Mm.
But that's kind of mentally damaging to revisit
old
wounds.
Yeah, because that was going to be my next question. I mean, there's a reason why you have the grieving process.
Exactly.
And if something very bad has happened, you don't necessarily want to be raking it up.
No, I don't do that.
Right, okay.
So the best thing to do is to invent something that would instill that emotion. For me, you know, that's what works for me. So I'd sort of imagine my dog dying or something.
Mm.
Or, you know, some other emotional event that would induce me to get into that state without it actually happening. So you can actually come back from that. You know, so there's no mental scars there. Mm. I find that works for me.
Mm. Okay. What have you been doing more recently then?
There was a TV series on TV currently called Murder Maps. I was in episode 5 or 8, one of the two, I can't remember which one, but it was aired last night. How I played the detective in that.
What channel was that on?
I think it's going to be on a lot of other channels, but at the moment it was on Yesterday Channel.
Okay. I've seen that advertised.
Yes, it's been advertised, yeah.
Yes, because it's actually... Oh, that's right, the advert's the one where it's got, like, the map of Victorian London and there's kind of blood spreading all around it.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. Oh, right, okay.
So there was the murders, Brides in the Bath, murders, and I played the detective that nailed the guy that did the murders, along with Dr. Spilsbury, who was a brilliant scientist at the time for forensics.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was airs last night, and then in January there's a movie out in the cinemas called The Fall of the Krays, it's in some cinemas and on DVD afterwards. I played the police commissioner. There's a pattern here, isn't there? Police commissioner John DeRose.
You do look a bit like a police commissioner, actually, Martin. I have to say.
Yeah,
I think you'd have done well being the boss in like the Sweeney or something in the '70s.
Yes, Gov. Yes. Yeah, book him right. Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah, you slay.
I don't think the governor's actually supposed to say that, to be fair.
No. I've been cast, I think, four times as a detective. There's a pattern developing.
I have to say, though, you see these careers of actors who are always cast in the same roles, but they're always in work. So, if you can get a good typecast, then good on you.
I don't care. I don't care.
As long as there's work for
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's what I've done recently, anyway.
Good stuff. And obviously, you live down in Devon, as I do. So when you go for auditions, I'm guessing there aren't that many in Devon.
There are some. There's more now than there were. You've got Poldark. I went for an audition for Poldark.
Was that actually filmed down this way?
Yeah, that's filmed down in... I think it's New Quay or Cornwall.
Right.
Well, down that way anyway.
Because my wife's quite a fan of that, although I think it's... Is it Aidan?
Yeah.
I can't remember his surname. I don't really care who these people are. I just know that she... well, there's an attractive man on the television, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Allegedly, yeah.
Well, yeah.
That's filmed there. There's Doc Martin. That's filmed down there.
But more
than that, there is some major films that have been filmed down here. And it's becoming quite a hot spot for... I mean, the Alice in Wonderland was filmed outside Plymouth.
Okay.
Parts of War Horse were filmed in Devon.
Right.
Some major movies have been filmed down here.
But presumably most auditions that you go for aren't in Devon.
No.
So you find yourself schlepping up and down to London quite a lot.
Yeah.
And how is that?
It's a slog,
yeah.
And it's an investment, is the way I look at it. It costs me money to get to London, and if I stay overnight, I'm lucky I can stay with relatives because my family is still up there. So I'm able to stay up there overnight if I need to, and then I get the coach back, which kind of works because I can read the script on the way up there, so it kind of works that way too. But it's an investment.
Yeah, I mean, do you find it frustrating that there's such a kind of London-centric bias towards... thing, I mean, all things media, and obviously politics is the thing I probably know the most about, and there is an incredibly London-centric aspect to politics, not least because the Houses of Parliament are in the centre of London,
of
and
course.
With acting, lots of the studios, lots of the casting directors, they'll all be based out of London, won't they?
Of course, and I think that's the price we pay for the lifestyle that we live by living down here.
Mm, you never think about maybe moving up that way to make your life easier?
I do sometimes, I have to admit I do, but then when I kind of, when I'm not there, I think about it. When I'm there, I can't wait to get back home. So it's kind of, home wins, usually.
Okay, and have you got anything else coming up in the near future?
Not in the near future. There is two projects that I'm working on. Well, I'm working on my own project that I've written two. One full feature script, co-wrote. I'm co-writing another one. One film director is taking one and running with it. I've got another one that we're working on writing together, hopefully to get that filmed next year. And I've also attached to another film, which I can't say too much about yet, but that's late next year. I'm attached to that, but that's a bit of a secret at the moment.
Okay. Good stuff. Well, thanks very much for coming in, Martin.
You're more than welcome.
It's been great to chat to you, and good luck with your ongoing acting career. Maybe... some listeners will be inspired to take a leap themselves, whether it's acting, whether it's something else they've always wanted to do. I mean, I presume you would say, if there's something that, you've always wanted to do, give it a go.
Well, in the words of Richard Branson, if somebody asks you if you can do something, just say yes.
And then work out how to do it afterwards.
Work out how to do it afterwards. Yeah.
Good stuff. All right, thanks very much. That's Martin Ross, who is an actor. Okay, so you've been listening to Mark Thompson on the Music Mill. We talked to Russell Whiting, who was a Labour parliamentary candidate, all about his experiences and how much money it costs, and then to Martin Ross about his experiences as an actor. I'm not going to be here for the next couple of weeks because I'm going to take a little bit of a break over the Christmas period, but I'll be back in the new year. And we'll be talking to more guests, and we're going to have a little bit of a rebranding of the show as well. Probably be fairly similar, although we might take a slightly different angle on some things we cover. So look forward to that, and I hope you have a good Christmas and a great new year. And we'll be back soon.